Welcome to the Ether. Today is Friday, May 6, 2022. Today on the Ether, the Oregon Blockchain Group has a chat with Deborah Simpier from the Althea Network. Let's take a listen.
Hey, how you doing? Welcome.
Happy Friday for those of us who are not, not myself included, but those that that celebrate weekends. Or have those, or for which those are a thing.
I think we're just going to wait here for a bit until some people get in, and then we'll start up.
All right, everyone, I think we're going to start now. Welcome. This is our first attempt at the weekly OBG Twitter Spaces little initiative here. Today we're speaking with Deborah Simpier, the co-founder and CEO of Althea Network. Deborah, I'll give you a chance to introduce yourself in just a second. My name is Eli. I'm the Director of Communications at the Oregon Blockchain Group. Co-hosting today will be Bobby. He is an analyst at the group. I will introduce himself now.
Hi, Deborah. Super excited. A lot of my research tends to form in IBC and like ecosystem and DApp research within the Cosmos ecosystem. I'm super excited to have you on, and we're looking forward to diving into questions. Just a little background on what OBG is. It's a communicative initiative from a bunch of students at Oregon, we are all looking forward to asking you questions today and having to take your time. So I'm just going to start off by trying to sum up some of your background, and you can give me your thoughts on whether I have it right or correct, right or wrong, and add to it if you'd like. And then we'll try and sum up Althea Network for those that are listening, and you can add on to that as well. So you're the CEO of Althea Network, just as Eli just mentioned, and the co-founder of Sommelier Finance and Gravity Bridge. I'm fairly certain that you worked for the government at some point. Worked alongside it, and you started crypto pre-Bitcoin through something called Folding at Home, which I haven't heard a lot of, but through my through my initial research on it, has to do with partitioning data across compute. And from there, you got into Bitcoin and mining. Does that all sound correct? Do you have anything to add?
That's pretty much right. Although I think that it's interesting that it comes across as being like working for the government. I would say that my work has been as an activist, perhaps in some cases against governmental initiatives. It does certainly tend to like find me working with, you know, friendly government agencies. Like we worked very closely with, as this is Oregon, Ron Wyden in like the net neutrality initiative. It actually was a part of back then forming the Oregon Net Neutrality Group, and really active in that space. I think, you know, it's interesting to, I think it could be characterized as working for the government, but in perhaps a bit different way.
Yeah, working alongside maybe. We're going to dive into our research on Althea Network, and we kind of tell us if we're right and wrong as well. So Althea is a routing and billing protocol and operating system for ISPs. It's a platform/firmware that lives on either consumer routers or core routers, and is entirely device agnostic. It began when the team realized that the system of internet capturing users provided poor coverage and quality for consumers, and people can pay to route on Althea or create their own ISP using Althea as a backbone. Would you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great characterization. I think one of the kind of important things to realize by creating this platform, we sort of decoupled the service layers of a network from the open access infrastructure. So that allows the locality of service to be, well, or the service layer to be local, where many different entities can perhaps invest in the infrastructure. And you'll see that kind of reflected in now our current thinking about tokenizing or infrastructure, what we call liquid infrastructure. I think the other kind of thing to realize is that this sort of system of multi-entity revenue share is in stable currencies, right? So it's easy for people to kind of come in and pay for internet in a composable way.
Just a really quick follow-up on that, and then we'll dive into some of the questions we got here. Is the general idea that we're basically giving more local autonomy to ISPs, and that'll result in more efficient distribution of of internet to consumers?
That's certainly a component of it. I think the kind of, there's two kind of core values that lead to an open and interoperable market of bandwidth, and then the locality of service, right? So we do think that systems that align people that use the internet with those that are like providing, which an open market of bandwidth does, ultimately are more sustainable and are better for everyone involved. And this is really modeled after what we see at the IX, right? So at the internet exchanges, carriers charge each other in much the same way. You know, using kind of a metered system of bandwidth across different peering fiber optic cables, bandwidth costs have gone down year over year, and capacities have gone up. And so that's kind of basically the same premise we're actually seeing being enacted upon with Althea. And actually, this has in fact been the case. So over the last 4 years that we've been doing Althea, the bandwidth costs have, you know, continually gone down at least, you know, four times in the majority of our network. So this is proving this thesis that if you create an interoperable market of bandwidth, that, you know, you're going to have a more aligned and more efficient network has actually proven to be true, as we've sort of seen these costs, in fact, decrease across the networks. And then the other thing, too, is it fundamentally makes it changes from a user captured or capturing the value of a network at the user, which is very problematic for a variety of reasons, right? That's when they're going to start, you know, capturing your data, that's they're going to sort of silo you. That's why we get the monopolies that exist. And that's where we also get the underutilization of fiber. And we see carriers go out of business because the value capture is at the personhood itself. Whereas if we create a platform for, you know, commoditized bandwidth, different kinds of service providers, all of that, then you're trying to utilize as much volume as possible. You're really sharing that same fiber line, that same infrastructure can be fully utilized. And it's a much more efficient system. It's a much more CapEx efficient system, and one that's much better for a user instead of the value capture at the kind of the person level, at the user itself. Sorry, that was a bit of a rant.
No, that was perfect, because this kind of leads right into our next question of what the dream of Althea is. And so I think you kind of touched on trying to give more internet to more people in a more efficient way. And so, like, our next thought was that what steps are you taking currently to try and provide this dream of kind of commoditizing wavelengths and creating the Althea network?
So before I get into that question, I also want to contextualize one of the other main value propositions of Althea. So you see a lot of the commoditization and open marketplace happen because we made one bandwidth a commodity. We did something called pay for forward, which means that multi-entities can be part of that bandwidth system and then earn a revenue share. That's kind of all about what we just talked about, that value. But there's another really core fundamental thing that Althea does, and it's what we call a price-aware routing protocol. So in your Althea dashboard, you'll have this slider bar. One side is going to be cost, and the other side is going to be quality or latency. And the user has control on a very, you know, discrete or second by second basis. If you want to heavily weight cost or weight further the latency of your connection, and then your packet will travel that route through the internet and pay those upstream providers. So, you know, this can work well in a fixed environment. It translates to how we build out our core architecture at the different data centers, right? So you could potentially even like select a specific latency that you want to route to as the sort of network densifies at the core. And like super exciting is like when we apply price aware routing protocol to phones and MNO and device level connectivity. So you could be walking around with your phone, select you want a cost. It's going to, you know, connect to cell phone tower A, B, or C, route through the internet that way, and then pay, you know, then pay those carriers. So it really sort of then starts to disrupt this good old boys club of roaming agreements and the big three telcos, right? And that's where we really not only get more internet to more people in a cost efficient way, but we also bring back those freedoms and the user choice back to the user, which I also think is really exciting.
Yeah. Wow. Very, very interesting. Going off of that, I have a few questions on, have you ran into, or Althea in general, have you guys ran into any challenges implementing implementing this structure, and kind of what are some of the barriers you've ran into so far with just getting this network up and running, getting users onboarded, providers onboarded? Like what does that process look like?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I'm going to take you all back to 2018 when we first got started. So we originally started with a helium-like approach, right? Just like we'll have a revolution of people just putting up these wireless devices. Well, it turns out that is really good, as you can see by helium, at like installing devices. But it doesn't, it does not create networks that anyone wants to use. So basically 2019, we're starting to build these networks. And we sort of ran into this, you know, this problem is like, and we decided to sort of break toward, okay, we're going to more closely align, with like other carriers and like kind of building our own networks and, you know, and doing the kind of lift there of building networks rather than sort of like, you know, potentially just putting up useless boxes. And so, you know, it's a slower growth pattern for that. But we've had a lot of good traction there and having, you know, we have, you know, fire stations and EMS and businesses and things like that use this as their everyday internet. And it's proven to work really well. And then we sort of looked at, now we're back to onboarding partners now that full stack is built out. And we also built out a complete set of operator tools so that we can onboard. I think they're really pretty great in terms of like agnosticism to different hardware manufacturers, ISPs, right? So now we're actually onboarding fixed wireless operators and people that run fiber and, you know, legitimate ISPs are also taking and running the network, right? So it's a little bit of a different choice. And I think, you know, back in 2019, you know, that was kind of a fork in the road.
Awesome. Okay. Interesting. So a pivot from the helium approach to focused on ISPs themselves. Interesting. This is getting a little technical and specific here, but what is the coverage like? So again, I do not know much about the technical fundamentals of internet provision at all. So I don't know if this might be a silly question, but what is the range look like? What is the coverage look like for people in these rural areas who are looking to adopt this technology on both a provider basis? Like, how profitable is it to become an ISP on the Althea network in one of these rural areas, and then on a user basis, what does this coverage look like for them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Kind of to Robert's point earlier, it is agnostic to the medium of transport. So if you have like a fiber network, it's going to, you know, primarily do line rates. The one kind of limiting function in the capacity of Althea fiber networks is that we do heavily encrypt it. There's two layers of encryption between, you know, peer-to-peer and then, of course, network-wide. But essentially, Althea, you know, is the same as whatever medium you're going to do. So if you go in fiber, you know, you can do gigabit per second. Most of like the wireless meshy things that we do, most folks are receiving between like, you know, 75 to 200 megabits per second. Like, for example, in our urban networks, we can deploy 60 gigahertz mesh, like millimeter wave stuff, and that has to be pretty close. But we can get 300-400 megabits per second over wireless. Most of the relays make about $5 per user per month connected. Of course, that is actually like just the function of the metered rate being remitted to their wallet. But like, you know, you can kind of roughly think that. So most people who are providing or hosting a relay with an Althea network are going to be making, you know, $50 to $100 a month, which usually pays for their internet. And they end up with like around $1,000 to $2,000, like kind of passively income. And then, you know, it is very passive. They don't have to do anything because they decouple the service layer. That network operator in a network is going to be that entity that is, you know, installing and responding to customer service stuff and things like that. And, you know, they usually make like a, you know, a dollar
per day. So like, just to sum up and tell me if I got this wrong, just to paraphrase kind of what you're saying, Althea is, the medium of choice influences the grade of the internet provided. And when you do provide on Althea network, you're kind of making enough passive income to distribute the cost of running the network to make profit. So tell me if I'm correct on that.
Yeah, basically, like what we sometimes see, like, for example, there's a rural network in North Carolina The municipality runs an Althea node on their water tower, right? So there's a little local company that provides the service that helps everybody get set up, that sets that up for them. And then they have a water tower. So they're part of the network. They're earning revenue. They make a couple grand a year, you know, potentially more. But that also, like, you know, offsets the cost of building the network because you aren't having to, like, if you're a carrier or you're a provider, you don't necessarily have to go and get, you know, tower rent for each of these kinds of things. You can just participate in this more cooperative type of revenue share. And I think that's also what gets excited as we need more higher throughput, you know, wireless as we get into like 5G and millimeter wave, that, you know, then instead of having to get pull rent everywhere, you could utilize, this revenue share type of agreement.
Okay. So it sounds like what we're touching on is that the barrier for Althea network is the actual architecture and tooling that the network works through. And go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I would say that the barrier is primarily that it's twofold. One, telco networks require coordination. And up until we developed the network operations center and network operator model, that was a little bit, immature. So as soon as we got that piece fell into place because networks need coordination and customer service. That was a piece that we were missing back in 2019. The other piece that I would say is sort of the other like hurdle to a go-to-market is that telco networks, production telco networks are expensive, right? You know, a couple hundred thousand dollars on up to tens of millions to do large scale fiber optic projects. So what you'll see in our, you know, go-to-market plans here post-blockchain launch is in tokenizing fiber optic cables, mobile network towers, and RF spectrum to make that capital expenditure sort of align with the network buildouts and open that market up to lots of people, right? Can you, because you could potentially buy a piece of a mobile network tower, for example.
Absolutely. This leads perfectly into our next question that we had about liquid infrastructure. So I just wanted to pivot from, you know, the barriers of entry, which it sounds like you guys are lowering CapEx to get into ISP service providing, which is great. And then I wanted to pivot to how NFTs just a little, because from what I've heard about liquid infrastructure, they could work together. So NFTs have become synonymous with PFP projects like Bored Ape and, you know, CryptoPunks and many others. And all of these struggle with, you know, from my opinion, one central problem of not having utility, but they do provide a service in their own ways, aka collectability. I was listening to you on a Twitter space and a podcast, and you stated that you could tokenize radio frequency spectrum by embedding contractual metadata in an NFT. Okay, first of all, that sounds wild, but I don't really necessarily understand what all those words mean. Versus the historical use cases of the NFT, which has been collectability, this is kind of more utility based. So I was wondering if you can dive into this idea of liquid infrastructure and how NFTs play a role in it.
Yeah, I think this is really exciting and fascinating. And it's, you know, it's definitely been some like conversations with Stargaze as well about this. But I think the best way to sort of kind of talk through this is talking through the use case in his historical way. So we actually had a carrier come to us and talk about this, you know, billions of dollars of radio RF spectrum, licensed spectrum that they had. And it's very difficult to find a market for that, right? Like, you know, how do you, FCC does an auction for RF spectrum, but if you're a carrier, you know, that's been historically very difficult to do. And there's some composability they were really excited about in the tokenized space, which is reoccurring revenue on a smart contract, right? Like, so easily just sort of picking that up in a like a lease way. And also, I think what was really exciting to them about NFTs was royalties, right? So if you're in the regular legacy world, it's kind of hard to like track that and correct royalties every single time that gets sold, right? But what if, you know, you essentially what happens here is you say, okay, the broadcast area is going to be in this polygon, right? We've got a hexagon of space in Seattle, Washington, right? And that's the broadcast area. And we're going to register with the FCC that you own this area, right? So then you take that registration and embed it into the NFT itself. So you essentially have a digital representation of that radio frequency spectrum being broadcast in a hexagon of space. And what's, you know, cool about that together with the Gravity Bridge is that the carrier, the telco, could set a, you know, reoccurring revenue to that in like EVM stablecoins, right? And then they can also transfer that can be sold, you know, bought or sold on a blockchain or on the Althea blockchain. And then, you know, all of the sort of like revenue coming to that is also transparent. And then they can collect royalties, which was very exciting for them. So it solves that pain point with supply line and tracking the supply line and tracking the past revenues and things like that. And then two, it creates this new kind of layer of composability. Three, it opens the marketplace up to new entrants that which is really exciting. There's really not very many before. And then four, you can sort of see that, you know, you can see transparently that revenue coming there as well.
Wow. That's pretty awesome. That is very interesting. Sorry, it's taking a second to digest all that. So it really is just creating a more efficient system, it seems. And again, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of trade-offs for a business to adopt this sort of model. It's really just once the tech becomes more, I guess, widely accepted in the mainstream, it seems like this is a clear, clearly, I guess I'm going to say better way to kind of model this network compared to the legacy systems here. So, wow, very interesting.
But wait, there's more.
There's more.
So the other, so like sort of like basically stacking all these end to end, you know, layers of technology and interoperability, what's also exciting is to the end user who is using Althea maybe on their phone or in their home or maybe, you know, in their car, for example, right? Because your car is like telco connected and there's metering and billing that could happen there. Then you create a very seamless approach to also, you know, participating in other kinds of leverages in decentralized finance, like in the Cosmos ecosystem, right? So it's very easy if you got, let's say we have most folks that keep, you know, $200 to $400 on their router at any point in time. Well, it's very easy to maybe then say, okay, part of this goes into a DeFi stable pool or something like that. Or if you're a carrier, all of that. So if you're like, you know, Comcast or something, think about all of the liquidity that's moving around their network that they're not utilizing at any given moment. Right. So you can very easily leverage that. And all of that's just going to feel very seamless and intuitive to the end user. So part of the empowerment that, you know, we feel like, you know, the blockchain and telco brings is not only in the kind of metering and billing and composability layer that happens there, but the UX to seamlessly onboard to, you know, I mean, in Cosmos DeFi, of course, very gas efficient. So this is a, this is DeFi that, that, you know, smaller investors can participate in.
So that's amazing. I think kind of what you're saying, as I understand, is that while leveraging the Althea network and running an ISP or running your own router, you can also use DeFi to make returns. And like, even as an ISP, you can do that as well through interoperability through Cosmos. So like, that solves so many pain points, and you can increase your returns just by providing internet on Althea coupled with the use of DeFi. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. And now we're seeing interchain accounts. So what can happen is you can kind of control all your Cosmos DeFi. Maybe you also want to buy some compute on Akash or participate in the Akash marketplace, right? Or you want to buy some DVPN from Sentinel. Like, this is all, you know, between IBC and the seamless sort of UX that can happen with interchain accounts, you really only need one onboarding system to do all the things.
Wow, that's amazing. So just in case anyone doesn't know in the audience, interchain accounts, and tell me if I get this wrong, allows you to access governance proposals, voting on governance, and access different use cases on other separate blockchains called cross-chain composability. I guess that's what I would call it. So that's what Deborah's commenting on. I wanted to throw it over to Eli, and he's going to take us into questions for if people have any.
Yeah, I just wanted to, me and Bobby have been asking a lot here. Just wanted to open it up to the audience. If anyone has any questions for Deborah or would like to make a comment or ask anything, please raise your hand and we'll get you on up here to speak.
Just also too, while we're waiting for folks to step up, I would say also, I think the other kind of cool thing about interchain accounts is IBC sends, right? Like, so you can send with IBC. Like right now you kind of have to have like an intermediary. It's a little bit difficult.
Hey, Deborah, what's going on? I was just wondering if you could talk more about where the like inspiration and relationship with Gravity Bridge started, and then kind of where it's at now between Althea and like all the competing bridging solutions.
Ooh, that's a fun question. So essentially, let's rewind back to 2019. We had always planned on building our Althea blockchain on Cosmos over in XDAI land, you know, rapidly. This, you know, still we're like pushing XDAI to its limit over here. There wasn't a bridge. Peggy was being worked on by the what is now the SIFChain team, but was basically stalled out. So it was sort of, you know, it was a key part of our stack that wasn't sort of moving forward, that we sort of then kind of like met up with Sucky and some of the other folks that were, you know, kind of looking to accelerate development there, and began to kind of build it out. And, you know, I think increasingly as time has evolved, I've become like very excited, not only about, you know, how it can work on interoperability with this telco stack, but also like that, you know, the idea of it being, you know, neutral and permissionless and decentralized, I think became more and more exciting to me, and also more and more censorship resistant. So, you know, Gravity is designed to be, you know, front end agnostic. Actually, there's several front ends that work with it right now. Anybody can make a front end for Gravity. Anybody can connect into it. And actually, we have around 22 Cosmos blockchains that use it to either send, you know, ETH based stables, or like Persistence uses to send Ethereum stuff to Cosmos, or the other way around, like Chihuahua coin that uses Gravity to send their Cosmos token to Ethereum to have a representation to participate in ETH DeFi. But, you know, and we've also now seen it forked. It's in other blockchains. It really has become this kind of almost cool, like Linux-like platform, right? So you have a lot of great minds sort of building on top of it, iterating on it, keeping an eye on it, you know, and then a lot of different Cosmos blockchains are free to use it as well. And I think, you know, kind of what we'll see evolve now is that we do have a multi-bridge, you know, future in Cosmos, which is probably ultimately great. You know, diversity always makes, you know, things, you know, better and continue to push the innovation. And what I'm kind of hoping that we will, or what we kind of plan on doing is kind of taking some leadership on that fungibility discussion. What are some things we can do to, you know, to make those things more interoperable in the Cosmos ecosystem? Like, you know, we could pool all of the USDC bridged assets into one pool and then have a representation of that pool too, right? So there's lots of different ways that we can sort of handle the UX of bridged asset fungibility, which is a fun new conversation that we get to have.
Got you. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, Deborah, we know you're insanely busy, so we were thinking of probably wrapping up here. If no one else has, well, it looks like we have one more question. So I'm going to get them up here, and then we'll talk wrap up.
And Deborah, if you have to leave, no worries. We understand we're taking up a lot of your time, and we appreciate you coming. So if you can't answer this last question, no worries.
Yeah, I had walked out the full hour, so you're okay. Go ahead.
Okay, appreciate it.
Hi Deborah. Althea is actually one of my favorite onboarding use cases when I'm talking to someone who has a very negative outlook on the blockchain industry and what could be done with the technology. I was curious if there's any other use cases that really excite you regarding like blockchain for social good.
Gosh, well, I mean, I think a lot of them live in Cosmos, right? So we're, you know, home of Region, and also like Akash, I think, is insanely exciting. I'm also excited about Handshake as well, sort of decentralizing the DNS stack, right? And a lot of those kind of come down to like protecting freedoms and user choice. And, you know, because I think a lot of what the blockchain can do is provide us with real ownership, right? So what does real ownership mean? And to me, I define that as having leverage over your own assets. Can you, like, you know, can you sell things with it? Can you make it work for you? And do you have choice of what can happen? Like right now on my phone, I don't really own it, right? Because I can't choose my operating system. I can't really make it work for me. You know, I'm at the mercy of the telco that basically owns, or, and I just get to kind of lease or use my phone, but I'm not a real owner. And so I think that, like, when we think about like Region's carbon credits, you know, decentralizing out like your compute with the Akash, those are all things that, and of course of Althea, that give us real ownership, and real decentralized ownership is where we can hold on to those key freedoms.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us and to answer the question.
If no one has any more questions, I have one just for my own curiosity, because I do a lot of research within the Cosmos ecosystem, and I mainly focus on it. I was wondering if you could tell everyone, what was the reason that you chose a Cosmos blockchain versus any other one? And what does it enable you to do versus those that aren't within Cosmos ecosystem?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, right? So I think the ability to have a truly like sovereign, you know, chain with a decentralized group of validators, I think is the kind of primary value there. I think the distributed proof of stake system does a good job of engaging and aligning a lot of different stakeholders. I think they're now, especially since Cosm Lawsum is a thing, there's a lot of composability that you can build on top of the blockchain. So it really kind of fit all of those needs for, you know, building a blockchain for telco.
Going off of that, what are your thoughts on Prop 69?
Whew, yeah, it's an interesting conversation. I think timing plays a factor here. Really, it's a bit about the, I think there's the kind of two things to think about here, right? It's a discussion about whether, you know, the hub is this very risk averse, sort of center that interchain security works and people, you know, can connect to it for the security part of it, or does it take more of a rapid iteration with Cosm Lawsum. I think one of the things that always gives me a bit of pause about the hub just kind of in general is, like, do we consider the hub validator set to be the most perfect validator set? And I think, to me, that gives me a little bit of pause about anything that kind of we think about in terms of rapid iteration. The kind of larger stakeholders are not necessarily the validators that I would consider to be, like, pretty quick on the draw there. So that's just something to think about. I am hesitant to put forward too much of my own opinions because I think that is a really nuanced discussion. There's a lot of good opinions on it. But one thing I think that hasn't really been talked about a whole lot is, like, the hub is really the makeup of its validator set. And that creates trade-offs.
That's incredibly interesting about Prop 69. I totally agree. There's a lot of different viewpoints, whether you have, you know, more conservative or more progressive. And I think those two are fighting for the attention of the cosmos, really. I was kind of trying to go off on a different question, really. What kind of conversations are you currently having? I think you've touched on this. What kind of conversations are you currently having with legacy telco providers? And what are their reservations when looking at Althea Network right now?
A few of the things that I've heard that I think kind of put it in perspective is, we have, like, a large entity like Google Fiber. We had a conversation with them and they said, hey, it's $70 a month for our fiber. It's good, you know, and we've captured a certain amount of audience from that. But we know in the markets that we're in, there's a bunch of people that's too expensive for, or they may not be able to have fiber to the home. Like, it's too hard to build out to them. And we would like to, like, maybe look at, like, white boxing the technology and just using the technology stack to, because it's prepaid, it's really flexible to onboard this whole market that we can't get right now. Right. So that's kind of one kind of conversation there. We did partner with an Inditel network in Nebraska and a large fiber network in Puerto Rico, you know, also primarily wholesale. And they're like, we want to, like, utilize our infrastructure more. But the way that wholesale providers sell bandwidth is in this, like, long-term 3 to 5 year contract. It's expensive and they kind of have tapped out what they can do there. So basically they're excited about using Althea because then the last mile providers can connect in, they can earn per gigabyte price there. And then, you know, the lift is really small on their part and they can onboard new customers. So really a lot of what I'm hearing from carriers is, you know, we pretty much got everybody we can get, right? How do we onboard this whole market of folks that either need to have, like, prepaid, maybe there's a reason why they can't pay every month, or it's just difficult to get that market, or we want to spend less CapEx and grow our networks. So both of those things sort of Althea fits the need for.
Great. That was a great answer. Thank you. And then this forms into another question. You briefly touched on, like, these people that can't pay every month. So let's talk about those. Last week we have a roundtable every week at OBG on Spaces, and we were talking about barriers of entry into crypto. And many people said UI, and others said the knowledge needed to just access a wallet or buy on centralized exchanges and then trade it to a decentralized exchange. There's another point that someone in our club made, which is just the general internet access across the world isn't equally distributed. So I was wondering, what is Althea currently doing to provide internet internet to those underprivileged communities. We're talking about CapEx, and you're saying that it costs less than the previous legacy telcos providers. And I think that could have a role in providing more internet to underprivileged communities. But what are you guys doing for underprivileged communities, and what do you intend to do for the future?
Yeah, I think this is a big focus of our market right now. And just because this is the Oregon Blockchain Group, you know, there was a study in Portland not too long ago when they were considering municipal internet. That I think it was 13% of all Portland folks have no access to broadband internet, despite having multiple wired access. Interestingly enough, if you look at just the Hispanic population in Portland, it jumps to 30% of those folks don't have any access to broadband. So it's a very intersectional issue across not only poverty lines, but also racial lines. And like some of these systemic issues that we have, like really manifest ourselves in this, right? We just kind of sort of keeping people underprivileged because they don't have access to this empowering, you know, broadband internet, right? So cool thing about blockchain is you can make things super composable. And that's what's super exciting about Althea, right? So we have an always on free tier, right? So anybody that's has an Althea network has a basic level of internet service. And then, you know, they can, you know, put more money in, $5, $10, doesn't matter. You know, they don't have to pay every month. They can pay sometimes, they cannot pay. And then they get the full amount of their connection. There's no like speed tiers or any of that, you know, BS, right? It's just pay if you can. If you can't, you're going to go back down to that basic level of service. And this is what, so we're actually rolling out Tacoma, Washington, urban San Diego, and urban Atlanta with a fairly high free tier, somewhere around 25 to 50 megabits per second, right? So this is like, hey, you're going to get awesome internet. And then, you know, businesses and other people in these communities could certainly pay into that and keep that network sustainable. But that's the really kind of interesting and cool different composability we can do when you can, you know, meter bandwidth, right?
I do have, we do have a requested question, but really quickly, following up on that, how is that sustainable offering free internet to people? How are you able to sustain that?
So what we found in our markets to be true with this model is about 25% of the people just can never pay, right? And about 25% of the people pay some of the time. And then about 50% of the people just pay all the time like they normally would, because they really just want the better connection, right? And the, you know, the most kind of a reliability they can get. So, and then, you know, obviously depends on what you do with the slider of like how basic your basic is. But for the most part, what we found is kind of that, you know, 25, 25, 50 split. And that is, you know, not only sustainable, but also, you know, you can invest in the CapEx and still come out with pretty good returns.
Interesting. Okay. Awesome. I am going to get someone up here. Sweet. Aaron, the floor is yours. I think you're muted, Aaron. Yeah, go for it.
I think while Aaron's figuring out his stuff, my question is kind of, more on the technical side. So
Eli, are you there?
Oh, go ahead, Aaron, please. Yeah, you're there. All right, I'll ask my question. We'll figure out Aaron's question in a bit. So in regards to like the chain, so it seems like Althea is very integrated with blockchain, with the blockchain that it's developing with Cosmos. If the chain is halted, does this, I'm assuming that you guys have some sort of escrow where people will be provided internet for a certain period of time before they don't have it anymore. And right. Could you comment on like how that works? Because I don't really understand it.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously we're working on the blockchain right now and XDAI. So XDAI has just as much problems as, you know, probably less, but, you know, because they're kind of basically, I guess, proof of authority. But, you know, they still have, you know, hard forks and changes and things like that and problems. So, yeah, we have, there's kind of two sort of flexible things here. One, there is like the amount of debt that's built up, like how much you can use before, you know, like you ask for a bill, right, from the different nodes. So there's some, like you said, a bit of a, not necessarily an escrow, but a bit of a, you know, forgiveness. You're going to build up a bill. And then before you build a kind of peer-to-peer router, right? Because it actually is a real like peer-to-peer system. But what's kind of happening behind the scenes is, you know, it's sort of counting how much you use and then like charging, you know, charging your forwarding amount, basically. And the amount that we sort of have in the grace period is, you know, is something that we leave for, you know, smaller types of programmatic things. The other thing too is that you can even, you know, kind of individual networks or you can decide to not enforce, right? So like you can, we can play with that as well, right? So and essentially let people, you know, continue to meter and bill and do all of that, but, you know, not enforce if there's a problem, right? So it's pretty easy to kind of like set that as a stopgap, almost at a like network-wide level, should there be, you know, potentiality for problems, which keeps, you know, keeps people the internet going. Because, it's I think this would be one of the reasons to make a bespoke, you know, blockchain, is so that you can, you know, make sure that you have that, you know, that uptime for end users. Like, you know, you can't have a fire station just not have be able to have internet.
Totally, that makes entirely a lot of sense. So in regards to enforcing, you guys can throttle down the enforcement level if there's a problem with the chain and allow people to still use the internet while the chain undergoes an update.
Well, right. And I think, you know, just to that point as well, it's a, you know, permissionless group of exit nodes, right? So this would almost, right now, of course, the, you know, the company runs a lot of them, you know, as we're kind of bootstrapping and getting this up and going. But, you know, later that can be, you know, more discrete, more finite. There can be different, bunch of different companies that run these kind of exit nodes. And that creates also another layer of resiliency as well, right? So as the system grows, there'll be, you know, more of that. And that can be set at a network level.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to throw it over to Aaron. Hopefully he doesn't have the same troubles he does, but if he does, I'll keep asking questions. Go ahead, Aaron.
Yes. Hello. Sorry. I don't know what was going on with my Twitter, but Deborah, thank you so much for coming to talk to us. I'm the new president here at the club. And this question is a little less about Althea and more about just your thoughts as a professional in the space. Obviously we're a student club here at the University of Oregon. We have about 50 members that are actively engaged in meetings and doing different things like writing and researching and pitching. What are the sort of things that you would tell us, the college students, to do to both educate ourselves and educate our community about projects like Althea and the larger Cosmos ecosystem and just blockchain as a whole?
Yeah, that's really exciting. I'm glad to see you all doing that work. And, you know, we've sort of extensively hired through the university pipeline and, you know, sourced projects. We work really closely with George Mason University, the University of Washington and Georgia Tech and a bunch of, you know, others as well. And would love to, like, you know, continue that conversation about what a further kind of collaboration could look like. One of the things that I think is a pain point in the blockchain ecosystem is, you know, lack of kind of outside talent kind of coming in, right? Basically, it seems like there's an incentive for people to become founders. You can raise money pretty quickly. It doesn't really matter if the project like actually ends up being successful. And that's a lot more attractive than potentially just working as a, you know, kind of a dev. But ultimately, that's not a a long term, you know, healthy ecosystem. So I think, you know, being able to sort of reach out and like interact with more new people, that diversity sort of really brings the innovation and creativity and resilience and health to, you know, the entire blockchain industry, which right now I think is suffering a bit from, you know, an insular kind of culture, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you. So in terms of like specific actionables that our club can be doing to prepare our members and just our community as a whole, just to keep honestly getting involved, to talking to professionals like yourself and to kind of get our hands on doing projects within the ecosystem. Am I interpreting your advice correctly?
Yeah, I mean, we worked with them as BAF or something from Santa Barbara. They did a really great job of like holding a few different conferences as well, that I thought brought together a lot of really great people. So, you know, either kind of doing spaces like this or in the extent that you can invite, you know, people to come and talk, that I think makes a big difference.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you again so much for spending the time to talk to us. We really value your time.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. I'm going to pivot. I do have one more question here. So Starlink, in terms of competitors, I have a friend who uses, they live in a rural area. They use Starlink as their internet provider. They have reported numerous issues too with that. So I was just wondering how you see competitors like Starlink. Is it a competitor, or is there room for collaboration there?
Yeah, absolutely. Room for collaboration. We have had several conversations with them in the past. I think, you know, like I said, we're medium of transport agnostic. So that doesn't really, you know, matter if you have like regular sized towers or if you're doing fancy space towers like a low Earth orbit satellite. Not necessarily like a competitor, but just another way to, you know, be able to hopefully decentralize things a bit. They are, you know, relatively centralized. It's, you know, one company that owns all the space satellites and, you know, all of that and the ground stations and everything. So I hope that they continue to be open to potential, you know, potentially decentralizing that stack. The other kind of, you know, thing to keep in mind too about satellites is, you know, they are, you know, they're capacity limited, right? So they're not necessarily going to be that urban, solution, but they, I think, work really well in, you know, the more kind of rural places. And what's interesting, I think, too, and I think actually makes a lot of sense, is like when we look at like building in places with smaller ARR because you just don't have a lot of people, like rural areas, if you can basically write a grant that's like, hey, Starlink is going to get all these folks out in the tule weeds and we're going to build, you know, kind of where we can make efficient ROI, that is a pretty good stack. Whereas like, especially in Oregon, this is a bit of an issue where if the mandate is get everybody in that census block, you know, if it costs $50,000 to get one person and, you know, everyone else is $1,000, you can see where it just starts to sort of break down. And like where, like we've worked in the Jewel and LC area out there on 26, you know, trying to put together, you know, good proposals to get those folks served. And I think, you know, Starlink is a good partner that they can really get those folks way out in the boonies.
So it sounds like you guys could work with Starlink if you want, but trying to decentralize the system further is kind of more so your goal. On the regards of decentralization, could you talk to how decentralized networks protect our core freedoms as individuals?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Okay, so I want to share with you a couple of different examples, right? So one, ASADA telco conference, the keynote, I think, was CenturyLink. And CenturyLink was talking about, hey, if you use our fiber, you know, what you can do is, you can actually, you know, maybe as a resort or restaurant or whatever, like Las Vegas or something, it's proven that you can actually shape human behavior, which means you can keep people at a restaurant longer, you can keep people at the slots a little bit longer, or whatever. And so they were like sort of pitching this, like, hey, if you have an apartment or if you have a resort or whatever, you want to essentially use CenturyLink, because then you can sort of control and shape traffic and then therefore shape human behavior. This is the inevitable outcome of networks where you are value capturing at the user. You're going to give away bandwidth so that you can essentially shape human behavior to buy or to do whatever you want them to do. This is very chilling. This is why we fight so hard, and I don't have weekends, because I do not want this future to come to pass. They are working on this. The telcos are working on this. This is what is happening.
So they're trying to control consumer behavior by providing them internet?
Correct. Because if you are the way, if you're the ISP that has the, you know, the, because with an ISP, you can't choose not to use the ISP. they can control how long you stay at sites, what, you know, what you watch, how long you stay at restaurants, what ads you see. Like, they can control so much of your experience online that then shapes what you do. And it's been proven, right? So that was the keynote speech, is like, look at this empirical data that we've shown you, that by controlling the network stack and basically offering it free so that you onboard more people, then we can actually control your behavior.
Wow. So basically, like, through controlling our own data and access to the internet, we can have more liberties that have been taken away from us by legacy telco providers.
Exactly. And it's not because they're evil, right? But the systems itself are like kind of fundamentally broken. And centralized systems are like this, right? You don't have any choice with that. But if you think about the way that like chain upgrades happen, right? All the validators have to come in and you need like 67%, right? In order to make chain upgrades. This will be the same if more and more people run the Althea platform, right? In order for there to be like fundamental changes to any of the core protocols, there will have to be enough of a consensus of people sort of allowing that to happen. And that's where you can kind of like hold and hold those key freedoms. And, that's where we got, this is why I started working on Althea, because it was 2016, it was 2017, net neutrality, was being fought at the federal level at the FCC. I remember working with Wyden's office and I asking, hey, like, what's the plan? How do we like sort of protect these core freedoms? And they didn't have one. And that's kind of when I knew like we could, like, for at least for me personally, I didn't feel like I was able to be materially involved in, you know, that fight to protect our core freedoms through a legislative process, that it really did come down to, we must build better decentralized systems. And, you know, together we can kind of come to make this come to pass.
Well, I'm all in on that dream and I will be here every day watching Althea trying to succeed in it. So just to wrap it up, I mean, then I'm going to throw it to Eli. It seems like co-determination between individuals allows for more freedom, which is kind of like what a blockchain does. We're entering into this social contract to decide where our data is going and trying to take more sovereignty over our, you know, like we said, core freedoms. And then tyrannical rule of like the companies today to maximize profits versus maximizing community good. That's kind of what we're commenting on as well. And hopefully I'm not overstepping and putting words in your mouth. And if you'd like to comment on that, go ahead, or else I'm going to throw it to you.
No, sounds great. I appreciate the support. And like I said, you know, that's the thing about decentralized systems. They are all of us together. So excited to build the future we want to see.
Awesome. Well, yeah, like Bobby said, I think we're going to perfect place to wrap up there. Thank you so much for taking the hour out of your busy schedule to come speak with us. We do look forward to hopefully having you back on in the future and just keeping up with Althea and the progress there. But thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Have a good day.
You too.
You as well, Deborah.
All right. Well, I think that's wrap up. Thank you guys so much for tuning in today. And again, we're gonna try to keep a weekly spaces going here. So again, thank you guys so much for listening in, and we hope to see you all next week.
Thanks for checking out another episode of The Ether. That was the Oregon Blockchain Group's chat with Deborah Simpier of the Althea Network, recorded on Friday, May 6, 2022. For TerraSpaces.org, I'm Finn. Thanks for listening.
They say rapping is the gateway, bringing home great pay. Checking that replay, sing along and we say nobody gives a fuck around my way. I make about $3 for every 1,000 plays, so add it up and do the math on that. Financially speaking, why the fuck would anybody wanna rap? But in this reality, the money comes from doing shows. But then where's the money go when you can't do the shows? I guess you could rap on Cameo. I've been asking all my friends if I can rap on the patio. 6 feet, motherfucker, step the fuck back. Doing a little magic, pulling rabbits out the rucksack. Not everybody's always in it for the money. Looking like another crooked Sunday and I'm working Monday. So you know I ain't stressing, left debating great methods. Amazed to play Inception, the bass stay blessed.
See, even with these huge sums of overall royalties, the sums of money that go to the record label per playback can seem insultingly small. Many rights holders are making around three quarters of a cent each time someone listens to one of their tracks, leaving only some portion of that for the actual artist.
Can't even say they're making pennies per play.
Until they can figure out how
how to turn a profit, their future will always be in question. But for now, investors see enough potential to continue to fund pennies.
Another day, another lesson, living in the 8th dimension, might be worth a little mention, living in the Great Depression, got a real regal feel, reeling in another sucker fish, out to make a deal, just to make a motherfucker wish. Aw shit, now you only got two left. You know what I wish? We didn't have any loose ends. You know what I miss? Listening to excuses. Now we're on the fence like we forgot how to choose. That's what happens when people don't know what's true. In the dark, eating bullshit up like a mushroom. In the lunchroom, just trying to laugh it off. Meanwhile, foaming at the mouth like a rabid dog. Like a fake mating call at the zoo. It's looking like the view is getting disappointed too. I'm working on the new shit, trying to produce it. It's what I'm willing to go through when I'm making my music.
Terror Spaces.